Good, I'm glad to hear it.
It's March the 19th, Masoret. In this article by Rabbi Pruzansky, which we'll come back to perhaps, I can't go through the whole article. It's called The Rise of Orthopraxy. But he's basically talking about the phenomenon of many people, let's put it this way, the way they practice Orthodox Judaism today. And in one manifestation, I guess this would apply to the modern Orthodox, but he's not limiting himself to that. It's people who are just punctilious in terms of the observances, but in terms of the whole way of life, the whole philosophy of life. I mean, they're Orthodox in terms of the practice. But in terms of the deeper ideas, what Judaism is about, they're completely oblivious to that. That's one aspect of it. For example, he quotes the Zohar. They have this in bold print. The Zohar, Parshas Truma, labels people who talk in shul as atheists. They sit in the house of God, but are oblivious to his presence. There are so many people that really is an ambivalent type of Judaism. The way I see it, I mean, he doesn't go into this, there's just so much you can go into in an article. But there is an element of ambivalence. And when people come to shul on Shabbos, and essentially all they do is talk about business, sports, and you know, so on and so forth. It's purely a social phenomenon. And you know, it becomes, aside from the fact that it's disturbing to others, in many big shuls you have that problem. You can't really daven. Even if it wasn't that loud, it destroys the whole atmosphere. But what's the point? One should ask the question, what's the point of going to shul? Look, nobody's perfect. Occasionally, you know, you may want to say something to someone, but I'm talking about a consistent, ongoing behavior. So the question is, well, what would be the purpose? What's the idea behind that? And this is an ongoing phenomenon. Person may come late, he walks in, talks to his friends. He'll open up the sitter a little bit. So that's a conflict, basically. The person's really in a state of conflict. In terms of his values and so on and so forth, it really has nothing to do with Torah. He's not really interested in Torah. But because of social factors, because of the way he's been raised and so on and so forth, he just wants to be part of the group. So it comes out. It comes out. There's a certain element of rebelliousness there too. A certain element of hostility. Okay, that's not the only thing that he talks about. It's basically bigger than that. He's talking about another phenomenon as well. And it has to do more with... See, this would apply not to the ordinary people. This first criticism is about ordinary people that go through the motions, but never really get into the underlying idea. But then he talks about a criticism which I think would apply to the scholars. So let me just read the paragraph. There are those of us who have become quite proficient. Crafty is a better word. In manipulating the sources, in finding obscure opinions that, interpreted innovatively, tend to justify precisely what we want to do. Such people no longer desire to ascertain the will of God, but rather to satisfy their own inclinations, while remaining in, quote, technical compliance with halacha, very broadly construed. It is as if they have transformed the Almighty into a divine caddy who carries for us a bag full of clubs known as, quote, halacha, and they reserve the right to remove any club when they so desire and use them any way in which they desire. Most lacking is the concept of the Jew as the servant of God. That is, it's a certain approach to Judaism, and we've talked about this, where the person comes to the sources with a preconceived notion, and that preconceived notion is basically in terms of what he wants, in terms of what he thinks is the right thing. Then there's the manipulation of the sources. You find a lot of this today, especially I think in a lot of these liberal circles. I mean, there's a whole big controversy now over what Rabbi Weiss did with the so-called ordaining of a woman rabbi. And first he used the title Maharat, which I don't know exactly what it stands for. I don't get that either, because he, at that point in time, he did not want to officially proclaim her as a rabbi. But you could see where it was headed. That is, she would have those functions and serve the purposes that a rabbi ordinarily would. But then, a couple of weeks ago, he took the next step and gave her a new title called Rabbah, as opposed to rabbi, I guess, for a man, Rabbah for a woman. And this brought out a whole reaction. The Aguda of Israel came out, a bunch, you know, with a lot of poskim who condemned it and said that any shul that would have a woman as a rabbi cannot be regarded as orthodox. They took a stand. And then just a couple of days ago, the RCA, Rabbi Weiss is a member of the RCA, took a similar stand. But why did he use the title Maharat? What difference does the title make? That's the latest controversy. Because I think in the RCA statement, they referred to the title of Rabbah. But they didn't mention anything about Maharat. And that's the name of the institute that he has. See, but that kind of stuff always bothers me. What difference does it make what the title is? It's what the actuality is. And you can see that these things, to me, they're phony. Because, well, what's the point? The point really is, and you see that, that's what happened. It starts out with Maharat. And let's pretend that it's not really a rabbi. But then a few months later, no, Rabbah. So that was the intention all along. And what's the difference between the names that you use? So you'll come up with a clever... I think that's what Rabbi Pruzansky is getting at. He's not talking... In other words, it's all types of cleverness. That's an illegitimate use of the sources. To be very, very clever and get around it, and the end result is you're getting what you want, what you think is right. Now, this is not the Torah. This is not Judaism. This is not the Masorah, in terms of who gets smicha and what the role of the men are and what the role of women are and so on and so forth. So if a person believes in the divine character of Torah, and that the Torah is the will of Hashem and the instruction of Hashem, so we have to be instructed by the Torah, so then we can't come to the Torah with a preconceived notion. I discussed this at when I spoke at YCT, Chovei Torah. Not in the debate with Rabbi Greenberg, but with they invited me back to speak to Rabbi Linzer, to speak to one of the classes. And they wanted to express my hashkafa. And I started off with this point, that which I thought was very, honestly, I thought it was very uncontroversial. And that we should approach Torah without any agenda whatsoever. And seek to derive the agenda from the Torah. Now, I thought that was just an introduction, that I was going to go on to certain issues that they wanted to discuss, but that itself became controversial. So I was really taken aback that there were people that actually had the notion that it's appropriate, that that's what you do. That you seek to find within Torah the kinds of sources and so forth that will enable you or fit the ideas that you have. They even questioned me on that, and I had to explain that because then you're saying that the truth is within your own imagination, your own sense of right and wrong. That's really the truth. So what do you need the Torah for? The Torah is merely a tool to give some type of a justification for what you already believe. That's not study of Torah. It's hard for me to take to have to explain this to a group of people, to take such an issue seriously. It's so obvious. To me, that is so obvious. You have the same thing in American law. The Constitution. That's a whole big issue. What's the role of the justice, the Supreme Court justice? Now, many take the approach is that they want to achieve a certain result. They want it to be a certain whatever, in terms of fairness, doctrines, whatever the case may be. And they are going to then approach the Constitution, and they're going to manipulate and which you can do. Any, you know, you can take something out of context, and you can emphasize, overlook other things which are contrary to what, and you can produce a result. That's considered to be brilliant. And to me, the whole thing is false. I'm not saying there's any in American society. I'm not saying that you have to be beholden to the Constitution, because that's from people. That doesn't come from God. That's not the point, though. So then say that the Constitution is saying such and such, and we've progressed, and we're going to change. We have a new way of understanding it. I don't take issue with that, with the result that they want to produce. That's a separate point. But then what do you need? What are you trying to make a case that this is constitutional? The whole thing is absurd. Because you know that's not really what the Constitution is saying. Now, it's a similar thing over here. The attitude, and I don't think it's limited, by the way, I don't think it is limited only to the liberal section of Jews, to the you know, the moderns and so on and so forth. I think it's much more broad-based, and you find this amongst the right-wingers, and you find this amongst the ultra-right-wingers, because there's plenty of criticism that can be leveled at them too, and certain practices that emulate the ways of the Goyim, but they're very, very from. So, and even Hasidus, and all the changes that they have made, and all the distortions that they have made. The only difference being that somehow or other, if it's on the right side, if it's the right wing, so it's more from, it's more religious, so then you can't question them because they're religious. But if it's on the left and it's loosening, that is to say, we have the Lo Susser. You shall not deviate. The mitzvah not to deviate neither to the right nor to the left, which the Torah itself recognizes that there's going to be two directions. Among that is to say, the Torah is going to recognize that for many people, the halachic system and the derech of the Torah is going to conflict. It's going to conflict with their own mentality, their own sense of right and wrong, their own mentality, their own religious mentality. And the Torah is not in line. The Torah does not correspond to any person's makeup. There's no person that has his natural inclination is geared towards Torah. That if it's just not the case. If that were the case, we wouldn't need a Torah. The Torah is the Torah. It's a system of truth that we have to aspire to try and get. And we do. We have to put aside. Everybody has their inclinations, their personality, their religious makeup. That's why it's to the right or to the left. For some, it's too restrictive, or it doesn't conform to their sensibilities. The role of women is bothersome to them. They want to modernize it, so to speak. And for others, it's just the opposite. They have a very strict type of a personality, and the davening, it's an interesting kind of a phenomenon. It's a very interesting kind of phenomenon, because you have a new thing. Let's take a look at something else. Has anyone ever heard of a Kalbach service? I was in California after the first Shabbos after we left New York. We stayed by the Feynman and went to the shul there. The rabbi is a fine person, you know. I think a Talmud of the Rav, and they had a guest rabbi. It was a YU rabbi, and I went there Friday night, and the rabbi introduced this guest rabbi, and he gave a nice Dvar Torah, you know, material from the Rav, and I didn't realize it happened to have been a Kalbach Shabbos, and then after the Dvar Torah, they had this chazan who was leading it as a kalbach. Then the rabbi and a bunch of people start dancing around the bima, and he pulled. I think the other rabbi from YU, I think he, you know, he was reluctant. He didn't want to join in. He saw, but this rabbi sort of pulled him in, and people are dancing. Then some people from the audience got up and they're dancing around the bima. So what do you think of that? No, I think it was part of the Kabbalah Shabbos. I think it was after the Lecha Dodi, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was after the Lecha Dodi. And if I remember it correctly, because now it didn't matter to me at what point. And then I think the rabbi got up and he introduced the other rabbi and he gave a very nice bar Torah. And I thought, we're going to daven Baruch Hu, you know, daven Ma'ariv. And then I noticed the singing. Actually, it was the chazan started. He grabbed the rabbi of the shul, but the rabbi of the shul was happy. I mean, you know, he was happy to do it. And then the rabbi of the shul, pulled the other rabbi, who was a friend of his, which I sensed he had some reluctance, but he just was pulled in. And a bunch of people from the audience, you know, joined, and they went around the bima a few times. So my question is, what about that? My question is there any difference between that and the ordination of women? Now, part of the RCA, I think, came out with a statement. The RCA, I don't think, was as harsh as the Aguda. The Aguda is much more to the right. And I think it sort of said that any type of changes of this dimension, actually, Rabbi Weiss has now rescinded. That is, he's removed that title. I don't know exactly all the particulars. I don't know if he removed it from Har, but he has this institute. And I think he said that he's not going to confer that title anymore. Of course, what about Maharat? I don't know. I mean, what's the difference? What the title is? But I think the RCA was saying that these types of changes can only be done with the consent of the the great rabbis. Or one part, which is definitely true. It's another big problem of this day and age. Certain type of issues, which even if they were feasible, even if they weren't blatantly against the Torah, still and all, you have to know who you are. Not every rabbi is the person who's going to get up and initiate these kinds of things. You have to realize that these are major changes and they require the consent of the Gedolim. But aside from that, I'm not getting into that. But what about this phenomenon? I haven't read any. This is catching on. This has caught on. It's been around for years. But why is that any different? Is that Kalbach services? I'm not an expert in it, but I know that they instituted. It's a change. Instead of saying after they finish whatever the lachadodi, they sing and dance around the bima. Now, who has a right to introduce? To me, that's a change. We don't have that. We don't have. That's not part of our davening. Certain things can be sung, so l'chadodi is sung, but that's it. We don't have dancing, especially on Shabbos, when dancing itself is controversial. It's actually machlokas as to whether it's permitted or not. There are those who prohibit dancing on Shabbos. And there are those who, the reason being it's connected to the danger of, there's a number of takanos that, or gzeros around the prohibition of fixing. You might fix, that's why you're not allowed to play music on Shabbos. For example, a guitar. Now, playing a guitar on Shabbos is not a malacha. It would be from the Torah, it would be permitted. There's nothing wrong with it. However, the rabbis made a decree against playing musical instruments because you might fix it. That is, a string could break. And you're engrossed in the activity, you might come to fix it. So therefore, they prohibited musical instruments. But alongside of that, a number of other activities which are associated with that. For example, dancing. Because once you dance, you have a tendency to play music, and it's all interconnected. It's not exero. There are those who say that it's permitted, bisman hazeh, because our instruments are different, and we don't fix them, things of that sort. That's a purely halachic issue. So that those who, for example, NCSY has gatherings on Shabbos and they want, or like you see, a lot of times you go to a bar mitzvah, a kiddush or something on Shabbos, and so they want to have singing and dancing with that. All right, so those who do, you can't condemn. They have what to rely on. That's not my point. That's a different issue. That's purely a halachic issue. But to institute it in the shul and you're instituting a new thing. We don't have davening as part of this. I'm sorry, we don't have dancing as part of the service. And it's not just dancing, it's dancing around the bima, which becomes a ritualized thing. It would be bad enough if people just danced in the aisles. But maybe it would be better that way. But the fact that they all do it in a certain kind of a way, that is around the bima, gives it a certain ritual. Going around the bima that we do on Sukkot with the lulav, that's a hakafa. So that's part of the masorah. That's correct. But to do it, to take it out of context and create your own custom now, you're just making up your own customs, and because you like it. So what would be akin to, so bring in a guitar, or bring in an organ. The Rav said about the reform or conservative shuls that have an organ, and then you can't. That's copying the game. So I was really upset, because I told Rabbi Feinman afterwards that had I known, I wouldn't have gone to the shul. I didn't know that they were going to do that. That it was a Kalbrach thing. Because it disturbed me to be at a place like that. That's a distortion of the davening. And you're just creating your own thing, and you're not allowed to do that in Judaism. So what difference does it make if it's that, or if it's ordaining a woman? But you're not going to hear the same kind of criticism. And then other changes that were introduced by the Hasidim. Other changes. The Chabad don't sleep in the sukkah, things like that. I mean, there's many, many changes that they've instituted. But those changes that they've instituted are generally perceived to be frummer, the frummer emotions. Holy emotions. He doesn't, in the article, he doesn't go into that. You have to read the article carefully. I think mainly he's dealing with this type of thing. I think the kind of examples I gave you, the mods, the moderns that come to shul and they have the kiddush club, stuff like that. He doesn't mention kiddush club, but it's not just that though. What about all the other crazy practices that have found their way into Judaism? These superstitious practices with the red bindles and other kinds of crazy things that are all superstitious, have no basis whatsoever in halacha. To the contrary, they're following the pathways of the idol worshippers. All of those things that they do, like we mentioned, that a woman that can't conceive should go into the mikveh after a woman who has had children, things, all this nonsense. And that the husband, before the wife is about to, when she's in the ninth month, and so on and so forth, he gets the aliyah of psicho. All of this is taking the system. It's the same idea. You're destroying the system, and you're just using it to cater to your own. These emotions are even, in my opinion, are worse. If we were going to get down to it, those types of practices, I think, are worse than the maharat thing for a woman, ordaining a woman, which is wrong. But this is not only wrong, but it's corruption. It's catering to the other one is technically wrong. So a woman's not supposed to be the rabbi. She's not supposed to be the rabbi. But a woman is learned and she knows a lot of things, and she can help people. Just can't do it in that particular venue. She could teach. So aside from that particular, the idea that a woman can obtain a lot of Torah knowledge and she can help others and teach others, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. But this is intrinsically wrong because the whole foundation of Judaism, that we renounce all kinds of superstitious, idolatrous practices on every level, and here you're taking the Torah itself and using it for that. It seems to me it's much worse. But you don't get the same fire in the belly from the Aguda and from these other organizations when it comes to that stuff. The Kalbach service, as I understand it, I don't know what the Yungifiel is going to do. It could be that they just do the singing. That's true. I can't say they all do the dancing. I think that sometimes they call it Kalbach because they're going to, all of the songs are going to be Kalbach. But that doesn't mean they're going to do the dancing. So just want that's a legitimate point. If it's just the singing and not the dancing, then it's not the same thing anymore. Because the custom is, the custom is to say, actually, the custom is to say those psalms. I'd have to think about that. It is a change, because the custom is to say the psalms, and then the lechadodis they sing. But there is no custom to sing the psalms. So that is also a innovation. But another thing also is why Kalbach? That is, why is it only his tunes? That's bothersome. For example, let's say you want to make it more meaningful. So you'll sing these psalms. I don't know if that is, we sing different parts of the davening to get people more involved. For example, in the Shmon Esrei and the Yom Tovim, Atavachartano, I think within reason it's a good thing, because it keeps people involved. Of course you have the problem of repeating words, but you can do it without repeating words. And these are long prayers, and people get tired, and they like some of the melodies. So I'm not opposed to that. But what bugs me is, what do you mean a Kalbach thing? Well, what's the Kalbach thing? Why him? He's the only one? Yeah. It does partake of the cultish. Well, as I said, why him? If it's just that the tunes... See, it's one thing, let's say we're going to sing. For example, there's certain parts, like Kehil Odon on Shabbos morning. Everybody sings that. So there's different tunes. So you switch off, the same would be true here. If you want to sing some tunes, like for example, Lechadodi, there's different tunes. So it's nice to have a little variety. But when it becomes Kalbach, that's acculturated. And then, as Rivka is saying, in some places they get up and they tell stories about him. There's this elevation. He becomes like the great person. In what way? What is his view of Judaism? First of all, we don't have a Rambam Shabbos anymore. Well, what kind of thing is that? Certainly you don't have that for truly great people. You don't have a Rabbi Soloveitchik Shabbat. No such thing. It would be wrong. For example, if a person wanted to have a Rabbi Soloveitchik Shabbos, and we would just say Dibrei Torah from Rabbi Soloveitchik, I would be opposed to it, and Rabbi Soloveitchik would be opposed to it. It's one thing if you have a yard site, when that's the yard site. It's remembering this gadol or that gadol. So you speak about him and what he stood for. That's something else. But where did you ever see that they took a particular person and made a Shabbos around it? So that's based upon that idea of a cult. And he's the leader of the cult. So his whatever it was, I don't even know what he stands for. His feelings and his emotions and whatever it is, that becomes something that everybody should aspire to. Which also doesn't make sense on any level whatsoever. We aspire to emulate Gedolim in terms of their knowledge, their ideas. We don't have a person. We don't have any other person that we have a Rabbi Akiva Shabbos or Rambam Shabbos. Never heard of a thing like that. And that's the people who are truly great scholars. But he's not a truly great scholar. I'm not saying this to disparage him. That's not. He was someone who had a very emotionalistic approach. It's all about his feelings and his emotions and his love and all of that. But doesn't mean he's a bad person. I'm not putting him down. I'm not speaking badly about him in any way. I'm just saying, I don't know how others take that and then elevate that and have a whole new cult around that. So to me, that part is bothersome as well. Even if it didn't involve the dancing. I'm surprised. I don't know how they draw the line at the dancing. Well, perhaps they sense that there's something wrong with that. The reason why this doesn't sound so bad to many people is because it corresponds to its pleasant emotions. It's nice. We have more fervor for God. Look at all the fervor. That's a big mistake that people make. They misidentify something which is not true religious fervor. When I say true religious, I mean in terms of Judaism, with something else. This is Gentiles. Or this is something which is people think they had a spiritual experience when they didn't. It's instinctively gratifying to their religious emotions to have these songs and dance, but it has nothing to do with any true idea. That's why I'm opposed to it. On an emotional level, and by doing it in the shul, you're catering to that. You're encouraging that whole phenomenon. You're saying that that's a real religious experience. That's why, to the contrary, people don't protest, because they think that this is better. Because we're just davening blandly. We don't have to put any feeling into our davening. They put real feeling into it. Yeah, but what are they putting the feeling into? Is it into the davening? Or they just, the tunes are very uplifting to them. It brings out certain emotions in them. Everybody has those emotions. That's not what the point of the davening is. You see the Hasidim HaRishonim, they didn't sing and dance, they contemplated. That's an extreme in the right direction. That is, they took an hour before the davening, preparing themselves mentally, and then they davened for an hour, and then an hour afterwards. That's how engrossed they were. That's a far cry from singing and dancing. But since this is more in line with people's sense, that's purely the same thing. This is taking Judaism and you're approaching it with your own religious feelings and emotions, and then you just manipulate the system to gratify your emotions. I don't see any difference between this and what the Maraks are doing. In many ways, I think this is worse. I was thinking about that in accordance with what we've been doing recently, the whole idea of the Chet HaEgo. And on some level, obviously, it's not identical, but that's part of the problem. And that's why it's a serious Avera. That is, that's what they did. They allowed the pressures of the moment, they deviated from the derech. Soro maher min haderech. They deviated from that derech, from that path that God had outlined for them, how they should approach Hashem, to put aside all of these other emotions, especially the idolatrous emotions. You see, the idolatrous emotions are the ones that are the most serious of all. And see, once you do that, you drive Hashem away. And what's the driving Hashem away? Is that you're not really listening to God. Your whole observance is now a compromise. It's distorted. It's not really a search for the truth anymore. So that's the, for example, the God sending the angel as opposed to God going by himself, being with them. Or you see it, for example, I mean, I'm just loosely, I'm just making some loose connections. Like Moshe removes the Ohel Moed from the camp. Well, what's the idea? So why can't it still be in the camp? What does it reflect? See, if it's in the camp, it means, see, that degree, we said, that God is with them, and they don't have to resort to all these tactics, which is the angel. That's not just that God is with them, it's the level that they're on. That's the edyo. That's the adornments. When they're on that level, that they're fully in line. They really absorb, and they're operating in accordance with the truth that Hashem reveals to them. The revealed truth, not the distorted one. But once they give into that emotion, that the really they're going to satisfy their own emotions, and they're just going to work it into the system somehow. That's it. Then they're not. It's not God is not with you anymore. You're on your own. You're living your own life. Your own camp is not. There's your camp, and then there's the Dvar Hashem is outside the camp. That is to say, in order to get the Dvar Hashem, you have to leave the camp, because the camp now is operating according to difference. It's not permeated with every aspect of their lives. They're not permeated with the philosophy of Torah. It's not. That, I think, is what if God is with us means, that every aspect of our life is permeated, like Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu, every does is it's all in line with the Ahavas Hashem. Every aspect of his life. It doesn't mean that we have to be on the same level as Avram, but it means that's the character of the society. So that's the way they were after Sinai. That's the Edyam. That was the distinctiveness. So once they sinned with the golden calf, they didn't have that distinctiveness anymore, because they weren't following the derech. So they were on a different planet, different derech. But they, as we said, they bowed. They recognized there was a recognition, but it was separate from them. It was separate from them. They stood for Moshe, and they looked. But you see the longing and so forth. It's a reflection of the distance. They were still able to recognize it, the greatness of Moshe. But it's not something that permeated the whole society. So that was a serious. That's it. That's a departure. It's a different phenomenon, and we can understand that. I wanted to give another analogy. That when God says, I can't dwell amongst you, I won't dwell amongst you, lest I destroy you. So we were trying to understand that. That see, it's not good for the person, in order for the person to have a great, let's put it on the level of, let's say, Rabbi Soloveitchik. Would visit you, would stay with you. Most people would say, wow, he's going to stay with us for Pesach. Some great rabbi. That's true, but how long could you tolerate his presence? He's too close. You have to be on a very, very high level. So you feel comfortable around him. But then if you're not on a high enough level, after a while, it's going to be a problem for you. You're going to feel cramped, restricted. You can't do certain things in his presence. You can't. So it's going to be it's going to bring out hostile feelings. It means that it's an impossibility. That you have to be worthy of that level of divine presence. When the divine presence, it's kind of like some people have told me, you know, when they go to Israel, they go to Yerushalayim. When they're in Yerushalayim, they feel that they have to behave themselves, so to speak. It's too close for comfort. They have this feeling. Outside of Yerushalayim, you know, they're not in the presence of God as much. So there's, I understand there's a certain emotion that a person lived across the street from the Kotel, say. So he's not comfortable. He doesn't feel comfortable. The person has to be on a high level to feel comfortable with the divine presence. So we understand that. The other point I wanted to make, again, these are very rough points, just slight clarifications of some of the aspects of the story. Now I think that the idea of Moshe, which we're going to go into, that Moshe is constantly praying to Hashem. That his presence should go with us. That if God removes himself from us and he only sends the angel, so then we're going to lose out tremendously in terms of our distinctiveness, in terms of the mission of the Jewish people, and so on and so forth. So we discussed that idea, that he prayed that God should not rest his presence with other nations. But part of it also is, and it seems to be disjointed, that out of nowhere he's praying that God will give him greater knowledge. Veidacha. That's a significant element, and indeed, that does become the basis for God relenting, for God forgiving them. The fact that he allows Moshe to rise up to a higher level in terms of the knowledge of God. So we can understand that, what the significance is. I mean, the question, of course, he wants greater knowledge. But in this context, his obtaining the greater knowledge will effectuate an atonement for the Jews. How so? It's because that's his task. His task is how to deal with the people. How to bring them around, to transform them, to be able to live in accordance with the true derech of the Torah. And not to distort it constantly. So the more he knows, the more Moshe Rabbeinu learns, it's a very, very difficult task, obviously, down to this day. How do you change people, their inclinations? How do you teach them Torah? How do you get them from this place to that place? And it's a very complicated thing. But clearly, the greater Moshe's knowledge of the ways of God, how, and by emulating the ways of God, then it'll elevate the entire people. You see that Moshe Rabbeinu would then go and teach to the Zakenim, and the Zakenim would teach to the others. But that's the idea, that he's praying to God to grant him this greater degree of knowledge of the ways of God. According to the Rambam, there's the glory of God and the ways of God, without going into these specifics, but the more he increases in terms of his knowledge of God, then the more it changes the character of the people. He knows how to deal with the people in a different way. It's an interesting phenomenon that the level of the people is very much connected to the level of the leaders, even good leaders, because not everybody can benefit from them. If the ways how you approach certain issues and so on and so forth. So it's something which down to this day, it's not a perfected thing that can have great leaders, but the ability to relate to people and so forth, and how to deal with them when they stray and so forth. All that is included in that. Okay, I guess that'll be it for today. These are just general thoughts. It was triggered by that article, and it helped me to get a more concrete picture. And that's, you know, some of the things, and like why Moshe was praying, and why if God would grant him this knowledge, it would bring about a change in the people. Very, very significant. But there's a certain, it's very advanced. All right, anyways, we'll go into that more, I hope, you know. There's a lot of particulars there. But I thought that it adds a little bit. Anyways, I guess we'll stop here.